History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. It's as simple as asking a few questions and investing a little time to listen, and then be ready to be amazed by what comes back your way. Our goal here has always been to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We've heard a lot this year about the 80th anniversary of D-Day. A few weeks ago, we zeroed in on the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Saipan. And there's another often overlooked Pacific clash that began 80 years ago this weekend. But the story goes back beyond that. You may know that the current population of the United States is estimated at 333 million. You might even know that California is the most populous of the 50 states with roughly 39 million people. But if you journey about 1,600 miles west of the Golden State, you will find 171,000 Americans who call the island of Guam home. And those 212 square miles of tropical paradise were the scene of an important three-week battle that commenced 80 years ago on July 21st, 1944. As opposed to places like Iwo Jima and Okinawa, which had long been held by the Japanese, Guam was actually U.S. territory before America entered World War II, but was for all intents and purposes undefended, and it was captured by Imperial Japan on the first day of the war. At Pearl Harbor, of course, that was December 7th, but across the international dateline on Guam, that was December 8th. A young Navy officer named Jack Schwartz was one of nearly 600 Americans on Guam who instantly became prisoners as a result.
We got a call about 5 in the morning, not we, but the headquarters got a call from Pearl Harbor saying hostilities have started. Those were the words. Then I found out, they didn't say Pearl Harbor had been attacked, but they found that out real quick. So everybody on staff got called. We rushed down to headquarters to see the captain, who was also the governor of the island. The defense plans for Guam, it was called the Rainbow Plan in those days, was just to do nothing. We were meant to surrender. There were no defenses. There were 100 Marines on the island, but they were mostly policemen for the island. So we knew we'd be captured at that point, just a matter of when. And for a couple of days, they sent planes over Guam and dropped a few bombs. There was a minesweeper called the Penguin, and they sank that. And a number of officers men were killed on that. And on shore, I'm not sure anybody was killed by the bombing. A few people were hurt. All we could do in the civil engineering was destroy all the equipment that was being used to construct the breakwaters. There was huge construction equipment. We blew out the motors and stuff on that.
So it wouldn't be used against you?
Yeah, so it couldn't be used by the Japanese. They probably could have put new motors in, but at least we did what we could.
I know this was a long time ago, but your memory clearly is very sharp. Most people haven't been in that position where they find out that in a major way it's hopeless. There's no chance of not getting captured, that this is inevitable. But how did you deal with that as a young man with your wife back in the States to have that realization, you know what, I'm going to become a prisoner of the Japanese or die trying not to be? How did you handle that and process that at the time?
We were all just in a hell of a spot and with nothing we could do. And we used to joke before that about eating rice and fish heads. We didn't realize we wouldn't get the fish when we go to Japan. But I can't recall any special thoughts on it.
Do you think it was a blessing or a curse to know in advance before you were captured that that was going to happen? Do you think it helped prepare you for it, that you had a little advance understanding of what was about to happen?
No, I don't think so, because we had no idea what it was like to be a prisoner. When the Japs did come in, they landed on a couple of beaches. There were nobody defending the beaches. This was all in the dark. It was early in the morning. And I was in my office in the same building that they had. It was called the Plaza. It was an old Spanish building, because you probably know the Spanish had the island before, up until 1898, when the U.S. took it over after the Spanish-American War. Typical Spanish construction, the walls were about 3 feet thick, and my office was down there on the ground floor. The Japanese troops finally came to the plaza. It was a group of Chamorros who were, they were the island patrol under the command of a Navy chief. And they were set up on the plaza with a machine gun from World War I, I'm sure. We started hearing firing, not an awful lot. And finally it stopped, and we stayed quiet. It was still dark, and I wasn't about to walk out and see what was happening. And it turned out, I know this for the fact, that the governor sent the executive officer down to offer to surrender. They made him drop his trousers and everything, stand there naked, but he did surrender. I'm sure a lot went out there. I've read about what out there in the plaza, but I didn't witness it because I was literally hiding until it was light. Anyhow, I came out with light with my hands up, and there they were. All the prisoners were all rounded up, Japanese Marines. These were not kids. These were experienced soldiers. You might remember, maybe you don't, the Japanese started war in 1932 in Manchuria and China. So they had very experienced troops. They saw us come out, and they stopped. In my pocket, I had a 5-inch slide drill. Nobody uses slide drills anymore. And this fellow took it out of his rack, looked at it, put it back in my pocket, saw my watch, didn't take my watch, and just rounded us up. Later on, they moved us all to a Catholic church, and that's where they kept us the month we were on Guam.
That would be the first of 45 months that Jack Schwartz would spend as a prisoner of war. We're going to come back to his story before we're done, because believe it or not, it would come full circle to Guam, which remained under Japanese control throughout 1942 and 1943. And by mid-1944, the Allies had made enough progress in the Pacific that the recapture of Guam was a possibility. Plans were to invade on June 18th, but greater resistance than anticipated on Saipan delayed the invasion. The Navy and the Army Air Corps bombarded the island off and on for nearly a month before the first troops landed on July 21st. We've heard from several 3rd Marine Division veterans over the years who fought on Guam. Quite a few of them would end up getting wounded later on at Iwo Jima. Art Smith was the son of British immigrants, the youngest of 5 children growing up in Lansing, Michigan. He landed on Guam with a special unit called the 1st Provisional Marine Brigade.
Of course, we circled Guam for 30 days, and the Red Cross said my mother was looking for me, and I said, I can't get back to her because we're circling Guam. And then we went down the rope ladders and in the Higgins boats, and you wonder when you got ashore, if you're going to get ashore, whether the waters are too deep when they let the front down. Ships were firing over our heads, and it was like all hell broke loose. Excuse the words. And the funny part about it, I was in this hotel, and a guy walked up, and he says, "You're Art Smith?" I said, "Yeah." "You were on Guam?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "I was with the artillery behind you." And I said, "You son of a gun, you kept me awake all night long far enough." He says, we got the operation open for you, you know, to go ahead." I say, "I'm laying in a foxhole and you're doing all that." But the thing is, I'd studied to be a court reporter, and they heard about this, and I ended up, would you believe, with an island commander, 2-star general.
Well, that was quite a journey, and I want to hear about it. But you just mentioned that initial landing there at Guam. Were you scared? Were you nervous?
Well, I was afraid if they dropped that front end down with all the equipment on, helmets and weapons and backpacks, and you'd go right down the bottom. But they didn't. They went right ashore.
And what greeted you as you came ashore?
A lot of fire back. If you could see, we got a medal for, whatever you'd call it, a medal, by the Secretary of the Navy. 1st Provisional Marine Brigade went through swamps and everything else, and made it through to the end. And something you'll never forget.
And I'm interested in what your mindset was going into that. I mean, I know you're a young man. You're probably just short of your 21st birthday, right?
Right.
Before you landed on Guam, did you think that this might be the last thing you ever did? Did you think that?
No, I didn't think that. I said, we're going to do it. I don't know. Something about joining the Marines, they don't have really any letdowns. You're taught to go ahead and do the best you can. And you can tell by that Secretary of the Navy when he wrote that medal for us.
Distinguished Unit Citation?
Yeah, that we had a determined operation to do. I mean, we laid in foxholes at nights, and I hate to talk about, you know, friends left not with us anymore, but they were part of the group that went through. I honor them very much.
Well, that's the reality. People did die, and there were some close calls for you. And as you came ashore there, can you give us a sense for what you were armed with and what you understood your duties to be when you first got there?
We had backpacks and pickaxes and everything else, and I had an M1 rifle. I'd like to think I was trained well in that, because I remember lying beside one fella, and I remember he worked for a store in Florida, and he had a wife and two children that left them. And he's lying down in the foxhole with me, and he started firing away. And I said, "Don't do that, don't do that." He says, "I thought I saw some action there." I said, "You're telling them where you are. And so he quieted him down. But things got better, and we had a good backing.
But it wasn't easy. I imagine those days had to be long days. And exhausting days, and maybe at times terrifying days.
Yeah, but when we got further on there, they started put up tents, and I laid in my cot one night, and Norma Shearer was singing, "I'll Be Seeing You." And it brought tears to my eyes when you hear, "I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the wishing well. I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, and everything that's bright and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you." You just felt like you were part of the group again.
So hearing a song like that overseas reminded you of home, made you feel like you're not alone?
Yeah.
I'm sure there are a lot of things that you endured, but what was it like to sleep in a foxhole?
Well, you kind of wonder what's you're overrun by toads about that time. When we rode the jeeps, so you kind of flattened them out. So then you never knew what was going to crawl into your foxhole with you.
You mentioned those toads. Like, how many toads?
I never counted them. I just pushed them out. They were all over the island at one time. In the jeeps, you'd run over them. But it's all cleared off. It's beautiful now. And that's where we landed at Agate's. They say it's a very great place to go. And they've made a memorial cemetery for those that didn't make it. And it's beautiful, too.
Did you lose some friends over there? Did guys that you knew that you served with not make it out of there?
Well, I'd rather not get to that. But I do remember when they started put up tents that there was one officer. He just got married, and all of a sudden there was a big whoosh, and we found out later that he had Japanese fuses, it looks. And I rushed over to him, and I don't want to mention any names or anything, but I said, "You're so-and-so," and he says, "Yes," but he never made it, so.
There was an explosion because something was sabotaged, or?
No, he just working with some fuses, they said, Japanese fuses, and they went off, and it was a big, massive shot of flame went up in the air. It's wonder it didn't burn the tent down.
I just want people to get a sense of what this was like, because none of us were there. We didn't live through it. What was the most challenging part, or the most difficult part of being part of that invasion force and recapturing Guam all the time that you were there? What was the most difficult thing?
I don't think being a Marine was. It was just getting it over with and stopping all this death and everything else. And then you know what? Some mother's going to get a letter. And that was the hardest part. You know, you're making it, hopefully, but you just try to do best you can.
Did you ever think you weren't going to make it?
Never thought that. I mean, you know, I had the weapons to do it, and if a shot from someplace else, like a sniper in a palm tree, took aim at me when I was driving a jeep up, and I had a lieutenant colonel in the back seat, the shot hit my helmet and creased it and took out my windshield. It's about a half inch more in my helmet, and it would have gone into my head, but they went back to take care of that.
So it hits your helmet, it shatters the windshield, and you just said, you know, very matter-of-factly, if it was a little half-inch different, that it would have gone into your head. You wouldn't be here. Your son would have never been born. What does that do to you when you realize that you just almost got killed?
Well, it's something you didn't think would happen. All of a sudden, it's just a massive crash in your window, and then you realize your helmet had been hit. And then you tell them that someone has to go back. And when that's what I did, I drove across fields like it was running out of gas. And they told them to need some help back there. But you never know what it could be. Other times it could have got me, too.
So the jeep was running out of gas? Is that what you just said?
No, I'm just saying I drove that jeep so fast.
You wanted to get out of there?
I wanted to get out of there.
Well, that's one close call you endured. There's another reminder of a close call that sits prominently here where you live in a big glass case there's a Japanese samurai sword. Where did that come from? How did you become the owner of that?
Well, I don't really want to go into that. I just rather leave it out. It's history.
Well, and I won't twist your arm, and it's your story, not mine. But I think it underscores the reality that you're here, but you almost weren't here. And if you don't survive, you don't meet your wife, your son isn't born. And the reason you have that samurai sword is because the person you took it from was trying to kill you in the middle of the night.
I'd rather not get into it.
Is there anything you want to say about that sword? What it means to you or what you think of when you look at it?
Well, it's just part of history.
Maybe let's look at it this way. Can you help us understand the different dangers that you faced as a Marine on Guam? You mentioned when you saw the guys coming back from Guadalcanal, a lot of them had malaria. There are diseases that you could encounter on Guam, I'm sure. And there are probably a lot of the ways that the enemy could get you. What were the different things that you had to watch out for as far as the enemy was concerned?
You know, in combat, you just take the best and hope your mind is doing the right. You can go wrong or right, or left. You should have gone left. Or when you got weapons flying over your head, like, take a look at that. Maybe you ought to read a little bit about from that Secretary of the Navy wrote about us. That tells the whole true story. You know, where we went through marshes and never turned back and kept going. Secretary of the Navy outlines it better in writing than I could. If you read a little bit of that, it would tell you that it was nothing to be around if you could get out of it.
You asked me to read it, I'll read it. This is from the Secretary of the Navy, James Forrestal. It's a Navy unit commendation awarded to the 1st Provisional Marine Brigade for outstanding heroism in action against enemy Japanese forces during the invasion of Guam, Marianas Islands, from July 21 to August 10, 1944. Functioning as a combat unit for the first time, the 1st Provisional Marine Brigade forced a landing against strong hostile defenses and well-camouflaged positions, steadily advancing inland under the relentless fury of the enemy's heavy artillery, mortar, and small arms fire to secure a firm beachhead by nightfall. Executing a difficult turning movement to the north, this daring and courageous unit fought its way ahead yard by yard through mangrove swamps, dense jungles, and over cliffs, and although terrifically reduced in strength under the enemy's fanatical counterattacks, hunted the Japanese in caves, pillboxes, and foxholes, and exterminated them. By their individual acts of gallantry and their indomitable fighting teamwork throughout this bitter and costly struggle, the men of the 1st Provisional Marine Brigade aided immeasurably in the restoration of Guam to our sovereignty. It's pretty superlative there, what he's saying about you guys. And it talks about that first night.
Yeah, he tells it better than what I could. I mean, he's got it down pat.
And that sounds like what you experienced?
That's right. We were in the mud and everything else like you talked.
On that first night, you were able to secure that beachhead by the end of the night. But that must not have been easy to do that.
The Marines train you very, very well. And you do the best you can. And we did go through heck, but I think he's got it covered.
Can you help us understand what that feels like to be in a situation like that?
It's like on a 4th of July night, you got a lot of firecrackers, and they're going out all around you.
And you don't know if one of them's got your name on it.
That's right.
Well, and then this mentions, I was asking you about the different things you encountered. This mentions some of it right off the bat, even that first day as you're landing. He called it strong hostile defenses, well-camouflaged positions, and he said you faced heavy artillery, mortar, and small arms fire. So it could be coming straight at you. It could be raining down from the sky.
That's right.
How close did some of that come to you?
Well, I'm lucky I missed it. They missed me, that's all. It's all around you. I mean, it lit up the sky. I don't know what else I can see.
Later on, you have the one ricochet off your helmet. But in this case, is stuff land?
That was different. I was taking somebody up. They still were in the palm trees and around you trying to take shots at you.
But during this initial landing and that night as you're establishing the beachhead, are there enemy rounds that are coming within a few feet of you?
They could be, yes. Well, I'm sure they did. Yeah. I was lucky they missed me when you read that.
You're saying that you're lucky they missed you, and you're seeing, as this is unfolding, you're seeing other guys that it's not missing, that they're getting hit and they're going down.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about that.
But that was the reality, right?
That's right. If you see it, you don't like it.
And don't you...
pretend to be a hero. I just happened to be there.
Well, and I'm not trying to make you into anything you're not. when you see that Marine who's 100 yards away or 10 yards away or 10 feet away going down, doesn't it occur to you, that could be me, I could be next?
You don't think of it that way. You just, if you stop to think about it, you're going to get it. So you just got to keep firing. And I can't believe all those things happen and how I ended up with a two-star general.
That two-star general was Henry Larson, commander of all Allied forces on Guam, who tapped Art Smith to handle all his correspondence. The three-week fight to recapture Guam came at the cost of nearly 1,800 American lives and another 5,000-plus wounded. It's time for our first break, but we'll hear from a couple Marines who survived close calls on Guam, including a Navajo code talker. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking 80 years since the Battle of Guam began. It would take 3 weeks and over 7,000 American casualties to recapture that island, which remains U.S. territory today. One Marine who came close to adding to that number was a young man named Bill Toledo, who for decades after the war wasn't allowed to talk about the secret work he had done, employing his native Navajo language as a code that the enemy was never able to crack.
We never talked about it for a long time. We just came home quietly. When we got discharged, we were told to keep our mouth shut. Never talk about it, you know, to our family, friends, and all that. So at that time, they told us it might be used again. So I think we were having a little problem with Russia at that time, and I thought that we might use that again. So that's why we kept our mouth shut for about 40 years. Nobody knew about how we did with our language, you know. And then when they declassified the code, and then they ran up all the code talkers, whatever they were, and we have a big reunion down in Phoenix. And then they put it in the paper, and that's how they found out people. The people found out how we use our language in the war, you know.
And now there's all these books about it. There have been movies about it. What's that been like for you? Something that you had to hold inside and keep a secret, and then all of a sudden it's made you a bit of a celebrity.
Yeah, that's what happened. And when we became known, then everybody wanted to talk to you, you know. We go to make presentations at school, all the way from elementary, high school, university. So we go to different states, you know, and different cities, you know, and make presentation. And then we go on the reservation, talk to these Navajo kids, you know, on the reservation, make presentation of the code, you know, how we use our language in the war, you know. So we became well known, and, you know. That's why we get all this requests, you know. Every time they want to hear from the Navajo code talker, you know, they know where we're at.
I know Bougainville was your first action, but just getting there, I bet you'd never been on a ship before. That had to be quite a journey for you.
That's right, yeah. After we were assigned to 3rd Marine Division, they were ready to move out at Camp Pendleton I was told, they were told not to ask questions. I met these 3rd Marine Division members there. They were ready to move out. So that's where I joined them. And they were whispering behind me where I was sitting. I was wondering why they were whispering, you know. And I finally caught on to what they were saying. This Indian that has joined us is going to be a Japanese interpreter. That's why they were whispering to each other, you know. So I got to meet them, this bunch there, and spent the night there. And the next day, we were ready to move out. We moved down to San Diego Harbor, where we boarded ship, great big troop ship called Mount Vernon. Before we boarded the ship, we had lunch. After we set sailing, some of these guys were hanging over the rail, you know, and I just wonder why they were doing that. Here, I guess they were throwing up, you know, I got seasick already. Because after that lunch, you know, so that's what happened. Then we were told that we're heading for New Zealand. So when we got down to Equator, they told us to put on our wintergreen uniform and go topside and stand in the sun for 1 hour. Because the sun was straight up and it was hot. We were standing there in the sun for 1 hour. A lot of these guys, they fell over, you know, from the heat. That's how we were initiated, going crossing the equator. And then we went on down to New Zealand, Auckland, New Zealand. They took us out about 20 miles out into the country where the camp was already set up. That's where we were going to do some training over there. The training mostly was hiking, you know, with a full combat pack, a bedding roll and ration and hand grenade. And we have a rifle. Ammunition, water. So we hiked every day, 20 miles a day. So we were there all through the summer. When 1st Marine Division secures Guadalcanal, they move out, and then we move in because we were told we would be doing some jungle training there because the Japanese were really good at jungle warfare. So we wanted to learn something about this warfare in the jungle, you know. So that's where we move in. They had this coconut grove away from the Henderson Field where we had set up the camp. These Japanese had the air bases not too far from Guadalcanal. We start getting the air raid, you know, at night, strafing the airfield, Henderson Field. So we had our jungle training there all through the summer.
What was it like when you got to Bougainville with all that training? Did it really prepare you for what combat was really like, or was that another awakening for you?
Oh, Bougainville. When we landed, I was supposed to send a message, what's going on the beach, to the headquarters on the ship, to another code talker. I don't know why the general didn't let me do that, what's going on the beach, you know. So after that, we moved into the jungle. It rained a lot on Bougainville. When you dig a foxhole about that deep, you know, the water will go into the foxhole. Makes you feel like you're laying in the bathtub and get all wet, you know. And we have password at night. Every night we have password. Mostly some famous boxer, famous baseball player or basketball player. So every evening we have a new password. So the Japanese, they move around at night, you know, and anybody comes to your foxhole, you have to challenge them. Who goes there, you know? If he doesn't answer with the password, then you can get rid of them, you know. As we were moving into the jungle, ahead of behind the frontline troop, there was a Marine, I guess one of the frontline troop, was walking behind us, and he was supposed to be with the other group in front, and I guess he mistaked me for the Japanese. He poked me with a rifle in the back and told me to raise my hand and turn me in to the commander. Told the commander that I found this Japanese walking with you guys. What shall I do with him? Shall I go ahead and shoot him, you know? And then the commander said, what are you doing back here? He said, you're supposed to be out in front with his frontline troop. Get your butt back in there, you know, and let him go. He's one of our men, you know. So he let me go. And without me knowing, I was assigned this one Marine. He was takes care of the coat. We share foxhole together. He was assigned to me as my bodyguard. without me knowing it, you know. So.
And that tells you the work you were doing with that code must have been pretty important for them to give you a bodyguard, huh?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, we memorized the code, and it's all in our head, you know, so that's why.
So what was that bodyguard going to do if you guys were captured together?
I found out later on from another code talker that they had orders. Somebody told him that when we get captured like that, the bodyguard will shoot you. You know, get rid of you because you memorized the code, you know, to protect the code and himself, too. That's what this one code talker told me. So if I knew about it, I don't know how I would have felt.
And this is decades after the war that you find this out. So how did you feel about it when you found out?
This happened something like 43 years after the war. But I went to see him, my bodyguard, you know, in California. One day we have this after the war. We used to get together, all the communication sectors I used to serve with. We go to a different city and have a reunion, you know. This one was in San Francisco. When he asked me, he said, "Did you know that I was your bodyguard?" I said, "No, I didn't know that." So that's when I found out. Long time after the war.
Did that make you a little emotional or rock your world a little bit to find out that he had had those orders?
Yeah, after that. But he didn't tell me that he would shoot me, you know. This came from another code talker. That's when he told me. And then later on, I found out that he was supposed to shoot me, kill me. And then that's when I started thinking about it. So I wonder how I would have felt, you know.
Are you glad you didn't know at the time?
Yeah, I was glad I didn't know at the time.
I don't blame you. And that, by the way, is one of the central plot points to the Wind Talkers movie. The Nicolas Cage character is tasked with protecting the code at all costs. Bill's bodyguard was too, but unlike the code talkers in the movie, Bill was not aware of this arrangement. And as you heard, he's thankful for that. But, Bill, I know there were some other situations you encountered in which that danger was pretty evident.
Another close call you had was on Guam, where you're running a message, and this wasn't something you usually did, carry a message, but they ask you to be a messenger. And tell me about what you had to do and what happened.
Oh, that one, what happened was we were about halfway up the mountain when we were spending the night up there. And that night we were attacked. Must have been about middle of the night we were attacked by the Japanese Banzai attack, they call it. Because when they attack like that, you know, they holler like, "Banzai, Banzai," you know. There was only somewhere around about 20 of them. It sounded like they were over 100 hollering, "Banzai," you know. So when the frontline troops opened up on them, they got rid of them. They destroyed our radio and they were throwing hand grenades, you know, all that. They destroyed our radio and our telephone. So I was supposed to be used as a runner. The next morning, one of the sergeant came over. He gave me a note. He said, "Take this note down to the beach where the regiment headquarters, so we can have another radio and telephone, you know." So he was a sergeant, I was only a PSC, so on the double, he told me, so I took off. I was supposed to let the my bodyguard know about it, you know. So I just went and took off, delivered the message. So we got another radio and telephone.
But you came to a muddy area that you had to cross, and all of a sudden bullets started flying?
Oh, yeah. And I came to a truck where they were loading some dead Marines, you know. They were taking them off the hill on the stretchers with the rope on, you know, bringing them down to where the truck is. And then they put them in the truck, and like a pile of log in there, you know. And some of those Marines that got killed. When I got into the clear there, I heard bullets going by, you know, and I started running. Before I started to move, you know, there was a bunch of Marines on the other side against the hill, and they were hollering at me, you know, and they were saying something, but I couldn't understand what they were hollering about. So I just went on and took off, just walking, you know, and then pretty soon I heard a bullet going by. I started running, you know, zigzagging like that, and I fall in the muddy road and get up. And here there was a sniper up in the canyon, way up on top. I guess he saw me going down there. He was shooting at me, and there was a Marine up at the top. This sniper was right below him. He came out of his hiding place and started shooting at me, and then this Marine saw him there, he shot him. And then he fell down into the canyon, you know, way down there. And then I started walking. I mean, I just kept running over there and zigzagging all the way. And then when I got over there, close to these guys, one of the Marines came over, run over to me, and said, hey, Chief, where did you play football, you know? And then he was telling me about the sniper in there. That's why they were all bunched up over there, because he's been picking off these Marines that were going by. So I delivered the message, and we got our radio and telephone.
He brought up football because he was impressed with your moves, dodging all those bullets, huh?
Yeah.
But they came pretty close, too. One of them got a piece of your clothing?
Yeah. Well, one of them, my jacket on here, she put a little hole there.
Mm-hmm. If that Marine hadn't shot that Japanese sniper, do you think you would have made it through there?
You mean me?
Yeah.
I guess while I was still out there, down there, that's when he shot him, you know, killed him.
So if he hadn't shot him, that sniper would have had a few more shots at you.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I don't know, I was a target, you know.
When it comes to your role as a code talker, you're one of the only ones that can tell this story and keep this history alive. What is important to you for us to know? What do you want us to remember?
I was very lucky to help put the story across, you know, to people. So they know what we did with our language, you know, and that's the reason I'm kind of glad that I did this. I did it, you know.
You survived those close calls you've talked to us about. You also were there the first day of the Battle of Iwo Jima. Your cousin was there, too. You guys actually met up there on Iwo. There's a lot of things that you lived through. Did you ever feel like somebody was looking out for you or that you were fortunate to survive in as good a shape as you did?
You know, after the war, I came back. I was at home, you know. I had this dream about the war, you know, that sometimes, what did they call that?
Flashback?
Yeah, flashback, yeah. That's what I get. And I suffered that for a long time, a long time, until finally it got so bad that I had to get treatment from my people, my medicine man, you know, to treat me for that flashback, you know, and then you went away, and I was cured.
Bill Toledo passed away in 2016 at the age of 92. Clearly, we can all be thankful that that Japanese sniper's bullets missed him 80 years ago on Guam. If you pull up his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, you can hear Bill singing the Marine Corps hymn, in Navajo. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, another Marine's unique memory on Guam, plus an example of why that island's recapture was so important to the big picture of the war in the Pacific, and how a man captured on Guam on the first day of the war ended up back there at the end. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this special episode honoring the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Guam, another one of the 65,000 Americans who stepped foot on the island during that three-week clash was a Marine machine gunner named Albert Mazzetti.
When we were on Guam, my men, I had 13 men behind me, and we were going up a trail, and it was through the jungle, and I hear this little boy yelling, "Hey, Marine! Hey, Marines!" And I went over there, and I looked over there, I told my man to wait, and I looked over there, and there was a cave there. And this little boy was standing out in front of the cave. Remember now, Guam was owned by the United States. It was the only island that I fought on that was really, it was Americans' possession that the Japs had taken over. He yelled at, you know, a little boy, 10 years old, you know? Oh, God, you're opening my brain up. I haven't said these things in a million years. So anyway, I said, "What's the matter?" And he was talking English to me. He said, "My mother and father," and remember, America owned that island. Yeah. So he said, "There's four Japanese soldiers in there that want to give up, and there's a Japanese nurse, and she's there, and we're all hungry, and we haven't eaten, and you know, they're afraid to come out." I said, "Okay, do you speak Japanese?" "The only thing I know is, you know, come out your hands, do not be afraid." And he said, "Yes," when he would know, you know, because being raised by the Japanese, you know, there. And so he said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, this is what you do. You go back in the cave. You tell them to get naked, leave their guns on the ground. And then when they come out, you come out, your mom and, oh, did I tell you his mom and dad were in there? Oh, his mother and father were in there too. And you tell your mom and dad to come out. You tell the nurse to come out. And then the last ones that come out will be the four Japanese soldiers because we'll be ready for them, see. And they've got to be naked with their hands up in the air." He said, "Okay." So he went in and blah, blah, blah. You know, he did his magic, you know. And what do you know? Pretty soon he comes out. His parents come out. Hatsuko, her name was, I haven't said that in a million years. Beautiful. Little Japanese nurse. Then the guys were standing there. I said, "Okay, tell them to come out." I said to my men, "All right, dump all your food, your sea rations on the ground here. They're hungry and they're going to take all of our sea rations." So my men dumped all their food out. And I told my radio man, I called the beach. I said, "Send a shore patrol up here because we got four prisoners for them." And they said, "Okay, Sergeant." So here come these Japanese, and they were naked. And so I told him, "Tell them to turn around." He blah, blah, blah. And he turns them around. Nothing. They were okay. I said, "Okay, fine. Tell them to get dressed." They got dressed. And I said, "Okay, tell them to sit down here." And I said, "Okay, you men, give them all the food." And they did. They gave them all the food. And then the shore patrol came up and took them. And Hatsuko, I used to go see Hatsuko. When she was in the women's part of the camp, you know, prison camp where they were. And I would bring her food. And then one day she wasn't there. And that was it. But I'll never forget her. Beautiful Japanese girl.
I've got to ask you, yes. As you described that scenario, and you took precautions making them strip their uniforms off in case they had something on them. Oh, yeah. But were you concerned about a booby trap, an ambush, anything
always,
like that?
Always, always, always. But I was equally concerned. Some of the Marines used to, if they wounded a Japanese soldier, they would prop them up against a coconut tree and torture them or knock their teeth out. Their rifle butts, you know, to get the gold teeth and that. I never allow my men to do stuff like that. Killing them, that's fine. But all this other torture and all that stuff, no.
Have you ever wondered what happened to that young boy who helped negotiate that handoff?
Yes, he's a little Guamanian boy, Spanish, because Spain for 500 years owned all that land. But yeah. Oh, I know what I forgot to tell you. The father went out and he came back, and he had an octopus with him about this big. And we had octopus right, sitting right there. We made a fire. He made a fire, his wife, you know, and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's, I ate octopus. All of my men and I ate octopus.
So you had given them all your sea rations. So in you know, a gesture of gratitude, he went out and caught an octopus?
That's true. Yes. He said, you have ever had octopus? I didn't know what octopus, you know, octopus, what's that?
But he knew where to find it, obviously.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Didn't take him long, boy. I mean, you know, he was built. He's just Guamanian.
Well, I've heard a lot of stories from World War II. I've never heard one about the celebratory octopus.
How about that?
As for reasons the Allied victory at Guam is worthy of celebration 80 years later, there's the obvious liberation for the inhabitants of the island who survived nearly 3 years of Japanese occupation. And of course, the 171,000 who live in that U.S. territory today are certainly thankful. But Guam also played a strategic role in the war's final chapters. The airfields on Guam allowed B-29 bombers to target mainland Japan. The firebombing of Tokyo is one overlooked but important element of the hastening of the war that B-29s taking off on Guam carried out. And if you ever pick up a book called The Last Mission, you'll learn how the very last bombs dropped before the Japanese surrender actually helped foil a plot to prevent the broadcast of the Emperor's surrender message. Roger Jensen will celebrate his 104th birthday this September. He was one of the pilots on the last B-29 to drop its bombs on that last mission. And he reminded us taking off on Guam in a B-29 wasn't exactly a piece of cake.
Our airfield that we had on Guam was situated so that at the end of the runway, there was a cliff. And from that top of that cliff to the ocean was about 75 feet. And so we, as soon as we got to the edge, we went down, you know, to get speed up to fly. And so we were in the number two position to take off that day. We were right behind the theater. And as we started down the runway, there was two runways we used. And there was a plane that would take off every minute on each runway. So there was a plane taking off every 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. And there was probably 125 or 50 planes destined to fly that mission. Well, we had an engine that was not operating correctly as we started down the runway, so we aborted and went back to our stand. And so we said, well, we guess we don't fly that mission. But the ground crew got it fixed. And by the time they got it fixed, the last plane that had taken off for the mission was about 15 or 20 minutes anyway. And so we asked them, do we take off or do we stay here? It's up to you. If you want to stay, okay. If you want to go, go. We said to go. So we went. And so we were the last plane to take off. So we were the last plane to drop that bomb load. And that bomb load was dropped. We dropped our bombs less than an hour before Hirohito accepted unconditional surrender. And so we were the last plane, because of that situation of our takeoff time, to be the last plane to drop bombs in that mission, which was the longest mission that was flown, combat mission out of Marianas in World War II. We were the last plane to drop the bomb on Japanese land. So we got word about an hour after we had dropped that one that Hirohito had accepted the surrender.
So you're on your way back. And for people to understand, when you say the longest mission, so you're going from Guam all the way to the northern end of Japan.
Which was Hokkaido was is the area. It was the last only oil-producing drilling field that Japan had. That was the reason for the mission. They said, we found out different later, but that's what they told us.
Well, there's a lot you found out later, and I want to touch on that. But so we understand how long this was. How many hours?
17 hours is the longest mission. We were 17 hours from takeoff to landing.
That's a long time. But you're on the way back from dropping your bombs. And you hear on the radio, Japan has surrendered?
Yeah.
That's a pretty unique place to be to get that news.
It's a good place to be any place when you get that kind of news in that circumstances. So everybody on the crew went to sleep, except me. I, I, I never did sleep on the plane. Other people could sleep when after we dropped the planes and headed back home, and you know, it was tired. Our average mission was about 12 to 13 hours, mm-hmm. but this one was 17, and so I just didn't feel comfortable about sleeping, and so they could always figure I'd be going, and had a wonderful crew and a flight engineer. All of our crew members were well experienced people. They weren't recruits, so it was really wonderful you have that kind of support and ability that that you had in your crew. And so anyway, that was the experience we had up to the time of surrender. Then what happened during that last mission at the Imperial Palace, we didn't know about that. That was secret information and was never divulged for 40 years. And at the end of 40 years, we were told what happened at the Imperial Palace during up to the surrender deal, that we were so effective, were part of that, not knowing it, for 40 years.
So for 40 years, you know you have the distinction of being the last crew on the last mission of the war.
Yeah.
But you don't know that without you guys flying over Tokyo, that the surrender might not have happened.
Yeah.
What did they tell you 40 years later?
Well, they didn't tell us anything. I mean, it was just made public or made available. The radio operator on my first crew wrote a book, The Last Mission, Jim Smith, and he wrote the first book on what happened on that last mission.
So help us understand the significance of that, of why the path of your mission actually affected whether or not the surrender happened.
Well, the radar system that Japan had picked up the fact that here were B-29s coming in towards Tokyo. They were afraid we were going to drop, another atomic bomb on Tokyo or on the Imperial Palace even. What they did then, they blacked out the whole area, including the Imperial Palace and so forth. All of the personnel of the Imperial Palace, including the Emperor, were in the dark, and most of them were in shelters. Herr Hayato had decided that he would accept unconditional surrender, but he never talked to these people directly. It was always recorded. He'd record, and they'd play the recording, but he never would personally talk to these people.
Would never be a live broadcast. It was always done ahead of time.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so the recording that was made of the surrender was done at early evening. There was a group of the high command group of Japan that didn't agree with the emperor about surrendering. They wanted to keep on going. And so they figured that if they got a hold of that recording that was down in someplace in the Imperial Palace, they could destroy that and the people wouldn't know about it. And they would hold the emperor under control, prison, I guess you'd say, or under arrest, so to speak. Being that they had to block out, there was only light they had was flashlights they could use, and they tried to find that. Often they tried to go to the radio station where it was recorded to the people, and they didn't know where it was. And others that did know didn't tell them. I mean, they just didn't tell you. So they did capture the Imperial Palace personnel and imprisoned them, separated them out so that his message wouldn't go out to his people. Well, there was two groups, and so the group that wanted to surrender were strong enough to avoid the other group that wanted to keep on under control. So they lost their support, and the leaders of that committed suicide at that point. So at daybreak, shortly thereafter, I believe, the recording was put out, and it was unknown whether the people would accept what the emperor said. And one of the conditions that the surrender did offer was that Herr Hayato would not be killed. But anyway, he made they played the recording, and the people of Japan accepted what he said. Just amazing how he could control those many people of something that was so adverse to what he was asking them to do.
Yeah, because up till then, it had been an honor to die for the emperor.
Yeah, that's right.
He was a divine figure.
Afterwards, we found out they had a lot of kamikaze planes that they had stored. Some of these people just thought they could beat us with those kamikazes. And interestingly enough, years later, when I was out of the service and in business and selling merchandise that I'd raised in Japan, I was dealing with a person over there when I was over there selling citrus. We talked a little bit about that, you know, the surrender. So he says, well, I was a kamikaze pilot.
Really?
Yeah, and here was a guy just like you and I were sitting and doing business with, a nice guy. And I says, how come you would agree to that? He says, that was an honor to die. He says, there's no question of you. You just don't turn that down. Anyway, back to the surrender. It was totally accepted. There wasn't an active resistance to the emperor's surrender.
But if we add it all up, if you and all those other B-29s hadn't been flying that mission, which some people might say, hey, it was unnecessary, they're already going to surrender, you don't need to get that oil field.
Okay.
But if you didn't, those guys might have been successful in stopping the recording from being played, right?
Could have been, yeah. And Russia was supporting Japan, and yet Stalin was with Churchill and Truman, and Russia wanted, in the spoils of the thing, to have part of Japan, particularly up the areas where we, up in northern Hokkaido. But we didn't know that. We found that out later. But that's the reason that we had that mission, was to keep Russia from getting that when we knew that Japan was going to surrender. We didn't want Russia to have that property up there.
So it wasn't so much to take the oil away from the Japanese, it was to keep the Russian, the USSR's hands off of it.
Yeah. Well, and off of the land.
Right.
See, they owned up to it. They were just going to expand their ownership of properties.
When you learned all of this 40 years later about that unknown consequence of that last mission, was that kind of mind-blowing for you?
Yeah, it was. It made sense to us after they told us about that. But we had no idea about why that happened. So that was, nothing heroic about that. It was just part of the deal.
It's pretty amazing how all those little details work together in the big picture. And before we close out this special episode today, let's return to the saga of Jack Schwartz, that Navy officer captured on Guam when the war began. While Roger Jensen was hearing news of Japan's surrender in the cockpit on the way back from dropping his bombs, Schwartz found out in a Japanese prison camp.
We were up to the camp, and the Japanese officers in charge of the camp came in and said, here again. Hostilities have ceased. And he and the guards just walked off and left us. There was no place we could go.
So you prisoners were all alone up there? No guards, no Japanese?
That's correct, but where are you going to go? So we painted a big POW on the roof of the barracks. And it wasn't until, I'm pretty sure it was at least 2 weeks before we saw a B-29 fly way, way above us. And 2 hours later, the parachutes were dropping out of the camp full of food. Boy, we all got crazy, throwing up all over the place, eating too much, but why not? Finally, a group of Army people came up, including nurses, and this is amusing, too. The first thing they did was spray us with DDT.
To kill all the lice?
Lice and fleas, stuff, bed bugs. We had them all, and of course they wouldn't do it now, but it did get rid of them anyway. And then there was, I didn't mark the date. I used to keep a diary, but I've lost it. But there was sometime about September the 8th when they finally came up with trucks and took us down to the railroads, and we took the railroad to Yokohama. There they separated out the Army and the Navy, and they put the Navy people on board the U.S. Iowa, which was there, and just stayed there overnight. And we were still in rags, and they gave us uniforms. They wore cappy uniforms then. And the next day they flew us out. So we get on the plane to fly out. The last thing I did before I got out was spit on the ground. And we flew for about a half an hour over Tokyo. What you could see was completely burned out. And then we came back and landed because one of the motors was no good.
Boy, you talk about a letdown after 4 years as a prisoner and your plane ride home has to go back to where you started.
Exactly. Anyhow, we took off again and flew back to Guam. What a difference, because instead of a little shabby island, there were airfields there, all kinds of things. And this is another funny one. They took us to the Naval Hospital. You'll never guess who was in charge. It was one of the Navy nurses who was captured with us. Because the Navy nurses were sent home with the ambassador in May of 42. And here she was back on Guam again as the chief nurse. Of course, it was nice knowing somebody.
I bet.
And we stayed there for about a week and sort of got used to living again. We got all uniforms. They gave us each $100, as I recall it. And finally, we all got orders and shipped home.
What an ordeal that began on Guam at the start of the war and brought him all the way back. And Guam remains a proud part of America today, thanks to the nearly 1,800 who gave their lives during a three-week battle that began 80 years ago this weekend. You can link to complete original interviews with all five World War II veterans you heard from today at hometownheroesradio.com. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.